Every month, we offer exciting new webinars for our community. Topics include how to use retirement accounts to buy real estate overseas, how to get a second passport in Latin America, why you should sell your stock portfolio and move your money offshore, how to buy beachfront rental properties in Brazil for less than $100,000, or apartments in Paraguay for less than $60,000. If you want to join us for free for these presentations with live Q&A, insider secrets, and exclusive opportunities with my professional network of experts, then go to expatmoney.com/webinars. That's expatmoney.com/webinars to register for free upcoming presentations. expatmoney.com/webinars.
We all dream of seeing the world, but the realities of living somewhere outside your place of birth can be daunting, to say the least. Welcome to the Expat Money Show, helping you make the most out of your overseas career through conversations with successful expats on investing, entrepreneurship, self-improvement, and continual education, all while sharpening your financial acumen. Now please welcome your host, with over 20 years of overseas experience, Mikkel Thorup.
Hey everyone, I am so excited about today's episode and I can't wait to get into it and share it with you. But I just wanted to remind you before we get going today to visit expatmoneyshow.com and sign up for my private newsletter, EMS Pulse. Right now we are sharing the weekly episodes from the podcast, but also a ton of other products and services that we're going to be offering, lots of language programs, lots of tips and tricks for being an expat, whether you're a first-time expat or an expat hopeful. There's just so much going on at expatmoneyshow.com. I really hope that you get a chance to come and visit us, join the newsletter, and then from there, maybe join our Facebook group at expatmoneyforum.com. Lots happening. I really want to share it with you guys, and the best way to stay connected is through these two sites, expatmoneyshow.com and expatmoneyforum.com. Thanks so much. Enjoy today's episode. Cheers.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. My name is Mikkel Thorup. This is the Expat Money Show, and today's guest is one of the four managing partners in Incrementum AG, an independent investment and asset management company based in Liechtenstein. They specialize in a holistic form of asset management and professional portfolio management for retail investors. Along with his partner, Mark Valick, they have created an annual gold report, In Gold We Trust, which is the gold standard of all gold study. And please welcome to the show, Ronald Störfele. Ronnie, how are you doing?
Hi, Mikkel. Thanks for having me. And you pronounced Störfele almost perfect.
Thank you very much. I had to practice a couple of times. You'll have to forgive my Canadian accent. So, Ronnie, why don't you take a couple minutes and kind of walk us through your backstory? How did you get working in gold and with Austrian School of Economics? I'm really interested to hear a bit about your life and your story.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I am Austrian. So I am kind of an Austrian. I grew up in Vienna, was always interested in equities, in the stock markets, in commodity markets. So I bought my first stocks when I was 13. I lived through the dot-com bubble, then basically started studying finance and economics. Didn't learn anything about the markets there, but I always worked part-time at different banks, the brokerage houses and so on. And basically in 2008, when I already worked full-time at a bank as an analyst, I came across the Austrian School of Economics for the first time, because I started writing about gold in 2007 because I invested in a mining stock that did tremendously well. So I went to my boss and said, I'd love to start writing about gold. Can you give me some time to prepare a special report on gold? And yeah, that was like the birth of the first In Gold We Trust report, which was very, very basic and kind of naive, because it only explained the supply demand picture of gold. But then at some point I started really getting sucked in to the topic, because I realized at some point that gold is about everything. It's about our society. It's about history. It's about monetary history, of course. It's about politics, geopolitics. It's about finance. And then I realized, okay, I should start reading like everything that I can get about hyperinflations, about currency reforms. And then in 2008, I found this brilliant quote by Ludwig von Mises. And I just Googled this old fellow, and I realized that there is something like the Austrian School of Economics. Now, of course, this is not taught at all in Vienna at the university, because Austria tends to be a bit more of a welfare state, very socialist sometimes. And it's, this wonderful heritage of the Austrian economists, Ludwig von Mises, but also Hayek, Menger, Böhm-Bawerk. They're not taught at all, and nobody basically knows them over here. So, yeah, that was like the point when I said, okay, I really have to order all the books that I can find. I have to read everything. I have to meet people that know the Austrian school. And that was basically the moment when I really extensively started writing the In Gold We Trust report. And as you know, last year we published the 12th edition of the In Gold We Trust report. We reached an all-time high, not in terms of prices, but in terms of the length. So it was, I think, 230 pages research about gold, about mining stocks, about inflation, about all different angles that are important for the price of gold. And yeah, that's kind of my background. And in 2012, I quitted my job because many people said, you know, being an Austrian and the gold buck sitting in a bank, that must feel like the vegetarian in the butchery. And then I said, okay, I want to set up my own company. And we set up this company with two gentlemen from Switzerland, and we met in the middle in Liechtenstein, which is kind of a very libertarian country. It's very, very small, 35,000 people living there. The Liechtenstein family knows the Austrian school very well, so it is actually within Europe, it's as good as it can, as it gets from a libertarian point of view. And yeah, that's my story in a nutshell.
Well, I definitely want to get into the report itself, but I want to backtrack a little bit. So I find it so interesting that you're Austrian, you grew up in Austria, but you actually didn't know anything about the Austrian School of Economics till much later on. Because when you start reading about gold and these types of things and anarchy and libertarianism and living overseas and real assets, Austrian School of Economics is super famous. Like it comes up every single day. So I just find that so amazing that it's not actually taught day one in school when you're going to college or going to university in business school. That's so bizarre to me.
It is bizarre, of course, if you have our view. But I think when it comes to economic professors, they just love their very, very complex models. They love their mathematical models and adding more parameters to their models. And then at some point, they realized that those models just don't work within a crisis. And I think for those Ivy League PhD, economists, the Austrian School of Economics is something kind of primitive, because it basically goes back to human action and to the motivation and the, means for one individual person. So, the Austrian school doesn't really care about those big aggregates like the GDP, for example. I mean, the gross domestic product, if I crash my car, 5 times a week, that actually increases GDP. But does it really, really improve our wealth or the structure of our capital? I would disagree. The Austrian school also says that inflation is an increase of the money supply and everything else just follows. rising prices, rises asset prices are only a consequence of our of an increase in the money supply. So I think the beauty of the Austrian school is, first of all, that it's very simple. Actually, many businessmen, they don't care about economics. And if I explain like the basic fundamentals, the basic premises of the Austrian school, I say, I totally agree. That's what I always thought. And so many people are intuitively, I would say, Austrian economists. And the second thing that I really like is, that the Austrian school, I think Hayek said, only very, very weak or poor economists are only economists, because the great economists, they know about a multitude of different areas, like philosophy, history, of course, natural sciences, business administration, and so on. So most of the people that I meet from this Austrian scene have got many, many different interesting angles and interests, and that's what I like so much. On the other hand, as you said, the fact that it's not taught at all over here is probably a consequence of, you know, the Western world that is very much of a welfare state. If you travel to Poland, for example, I held a lecture in Poland at a conference last year. People know Hayek. They know Mises very, very well. If you go to Czech Republic, if you go to Romania, all those former socialist countries, that know how socialism feels, they've got much, much more interest in the Austrian School of Economics and those libertarian views than people in the Western world, where everything is, at least for now, still fine on the surface.
So maybe it would be helpful for my listeners, give a very, very brief overview of Austrian economics and then why it relates itself so well to, say, gold, silver, precious metals, things like this.
Well, first of all, I would say that the Austrian School of Economics, when it comes to investing, and this is a point that many people got wrong in the last couple of years, because in 2008, after the great financial crisis, I think there was some sort of a renaissance of the Austrian School of Economics. Many people started reading about the Austrian school, started studying the Austrian school, and many also from the gold scene thought, okay, gold bugs equals followers of the Austrian School of Economics and will lead to excellent results for investors. From my point of view, and we wrote the book about the Austrian School for Investors, from my point of view, knowing the Austrian school doesn't necessarily make you a better investor, but it gives you another very, very important tool for your toolbox. And I think this tool is basically understanding the interplay between inflation and deflation. So from my point of view, we're not in a cyclical crisis at the moment. We're in a systemic crisis, in a crisis of our monetary system. And if you want to go back to the root causes of this problem and many problems that we're facing at the moment, you will probably end up on 15th of August in 1971, when Richard Nixon temporarily abandoned the gold backing of the U.S. dollar. So from my point of view, it's important to really understand the system and not only analyze the symptoms that we're seeing. And this is one of the beauties of the Austrian school, that it's the only school compared to monetarists and Keynesians that really wants to explain the big picture, the systemic flaws that we're seeing in our monetary system. So most of the charts that we are publishing in our Ingoldrich Trust reports, they start in 1971 or even earlier, because this was the point when a new era of our monetary system started. And from my point of view, this era is probably gonna end in the next couple of years. It will not be the end of the world. There are still plenty of entrepreneurial spirits. There's lots of capital that is not wasted yet, although we're basically eating up our capital structure. But if you study history, monetary reforms happen every couple of decades. So from my point of view, the next crisis won't be just a financial crisis. It will be a crisis of our monetary system. And within such a crisis and or within the transition phase from one system to another, gold always played a major, major role.
Okay, so 1971, Nixon dissolves the Bretton Woods agreement. You said temporarily take us off the gold standard. Dig into that for a little bit, because that's like a little hook there that I really want to hear more about your opinion. You think that we will return to the gold standard? How do you think that things will work?
Well, I really have to urge all your listeners to look up the speech by Richard Nixon on YouTube. You can find it very easily. It's just pure propaganda. And of course, Nixon blames the evil international money speculators that, and says that for the average American, it doesn't have any consequences if, at least temporarily, the gold backing of the US dollars is stopped. But of course, it has massive consequences. The 1970s were highly stagflationary environment, so we had very, very low growth, we had a recession, but we had very, very high price inflation. And on the other hand, of course, if you have a look at debt situation, fiscal deficits and so on, everything basically started in 1971, because from that point on, this big monetary experiment just started, this experiment of basically global fiat money. So from my point of view, I think there's a good reason why all the important central banks all over the globe still hold gold. There's, of course, the US still holding 8,100 tons. Of course, there's rumors or conspiracy theories that it's not there anymore. I don't think so.
You don't think that the rumors are true about it being gone, or you don't think that it's there?
No, I think it's there. I mean, I've never really read good or convincing comments or points that, that casted any doubts that the gold is still there. The Eurozone holds more than 10,000 tons of gold. And actually when the euro was introduced, it was really, one of the main messages of the whole, PR campaign, saying or creating trust in the new currency. They said, okay, we've got more than 10,000 tons of gold. This is some sort of the backing of this new, currency called euro. Then, of course, the Russians are buying, gold every month. The Chinese just said that they increased their gold reserves. Countries like Kazakhstan, I've been there, last year. They permanently buy gold. The IMF holds more than 3,000 tons of gold. And I think our advisory board member, Jim Rickards, he perfectly explains, the big picture. He says, if you want to play poker with the big guys, you got to bring chips to the table, and those chips are golden. So from my point of view, all the important central banks, the all important countries, they own gold. They constantly buy gold. In the Western world, on average, we've got 20% of our reserves are in gold. For emerging markets, it's at the moment only 1.9%, but it's increasing. So I think that sooner or later, there will be a monetary reset. This will not be the end of the world, as I've said before, but in this transition phase, gold will definitely play a major, major role.
Well, that's super interesting. And I would love to see gold go the way that we're talking about right now. But I just have this, I don't know if it's a fear or a concern or what it is in the back of my head, but I just don't imagine that politicians and people and central bankers and the people who basically run planet Earth are going to let something like that happen. They've waged a war on cash. We have no more cash. Our cash is worthless. They've turned on the printing presses whenever they want. They print dollars like it's going out of fashion. And through that, they have an amazing amount of control. By going back to a gold standard, they would lose pretty much all of that control. And I, even though it might be the right thing to do and it might be the solution to problems, I just find it difficult that they would ever relinquish that type of power.
Yeah, well, I don't necessarily think that there will be a typical or a classical gold standard, because actually during history, like there were many, many, many different forms of gold standards, but the classical gold standard that we've had until 1914, basically, which was also kind of called the golden era. Stefan Zweig brilliantly describes this time in his fantastic book, The World of Yesterday. It's really one of my very favorite books, because it brilliantly shows what war and especially the hyperinflation in Austria and in Germany did to our societies, and what horrible consequences hyperinflation has, and that it leads to wars and so on. So this is definitely a book recommendation I have to make, The World of Yesterday by Stefan Zweig. So the times of the classical gold standard, I don't think that they're gonna come back. But I think that, you know, if there would be some sort of a revaluation to $5,000 to $10,000 dollars per ounce, that would definitely have enormous positive consequences for many countries. We are running the numbers in our reports. We've had that in the 2017 and 2016 reports. What a revaluation would mean, and what price levels we actually would need. And actually, such a revaluation, if you see it from the other side, that's just a devaluation of paper money against gold, because from my point of view, gold is constant, and not the gold price is rising. It's rather purchasing power of fiat money that is falling. And from my point of view, the fact that that people always think that rising equity markets or rising real estate markets are something positive, you can discuss it, because it also means that your purchasing power relative to real estate or to stocks is permanently falling. So from my point of view, gold is basically in the center of our system, and it's other asset classes and currencies are revaluating permanently against this golden constant, which kind of measures purchasing power. Of course, the question that you asked, it also kind of leads to the question, okay, if there would be some sort of a revaluation, wouldn't they try to ban gold, the physical possession of gold, or if perhaps they might heavily tax it? Of course, we've had that in history a couple of times. Actually, there was one of the first measures by Hitler and also by Mussolini and Stalin, that they forbid physical possession of gold for private individuals. But I think nowadays that's even tougher, and we should not forget, every time that gold was forbidden, it still had an official monetary value. At the moment, it doesn't. There's no official link between fiat money and gold. So therefore, I am not 100% convinced by the argument that there might be a gold ban. But of course, we cannot rule it out. And I think nobody would have expected a couple of years ago that we would see negative interest rates in a couple of countries, that we would see massive quantitative easing experiments by basically all the major central banks. Nobody would have expected that Donald Trump would become U.S. president. So, this is also one of the, I think one of the main, differences of the Austrian School of Economics. It's very, very modest when it comes to forecasts. So, the Austrian School doesn't really make any bold forecasts. It just can analyze the past, and the present and come to some sort of conclusions. But we could never say, okay, this is going to happen by, I don't know, fall 2022, whatever. Because, you know, we should not underestimate all the different forces that are permanently at work. The entrepreneurial spirit that's still around despite all the problems that we're having. There's brilliant innovators out there trying to create products, to create solutions. Of course, cryptocurrencies are one of those innovations that nobody would have expected, but it was basically invented because of the 2008 great financial crisis. I think that was one of the main catalysts for cryptocurrencies. So I'm very, very positive when it comes to the longer term picture, because I think that The Ultimate Resource, and that's also a great book by Julian Simon, The Ultimate Resource is in between our ears. So when push comes to shove, I think the ultimate resource, our brain power, our will to innovate is coming. So that makes me for the long term very, very, very optimistic.
Well, I was listening to an interview with you this morning, actually. I was just kind of brushing up on some of the things that you do. And when cryptocurrency came up, the topic of cryptocurrency, you mentioned how happy you were to see young people actually discussing money again. And I listened to that and I was like, well, that's absolutely true. You know, I'm an expat. I travel around the world. I've been to more than 100 countries. I've been overseas for 20 years. But I work at that crossroads between the travel and living abroad and the financial side. And I'm 35 years old. And these topics, they fascinate me. And you're right, with the cryptocurrency, you saw thousands and hundreds of thousands of people really starting to discuss money and monetary and economics and policy, which I never saw growing up. And I would think a lot of people would agree with me. It was just not something we talked about. Like, we were always taught, yeah, you never speak about money. Like, that was my father's voice. You never speak about money. But those things are really changing. So I think that really lends to what you're saying now today again.
We're just going to pause for a second on the interview because I want to tell you about this special resource that I have for you. It's called 19 International Strategies to Grow and Protect Your Wealth Abroad. It is a PDF downloadable report, and you're going to find it at expatmoneyshow.com. Okay, why do I want to tell you about this? Well, it is an amazing resource for anyone out there who is looking to go offshore, to become an expat, expat hopefuls. If you're looking at immigration or Plan B residencies or any of these types of things that we talk about on the show, this really condenses the information into really easy to understand. And then from there, it gives you all the resources, links to the additional resources or who you can work with, the professionals involved in this. So I've had some amazing feedback on this, and I want to give it to you free, 100% free. All you need to do is go to expatmoneyshow.com, and at the very top of the page, you will see the special report. You can sign up. There's no credit card needed. There's no nothing like that. I just want you to have this resource because I think it's really important, and I think it's going to really serve you well. So enjoy. Go to expatmoneyshow.com, download your free special report, and let's jump back into today's interview.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the whole crypto ecosystem or the whole crypto scene, I think it's for me, it's really interesting to see because of course there's many young, sometimes a bit naive people that just want to change the world and to deliver really good products and make a shitload of money, and that's totally fine. But I've also seen some really, really weird business models and proposals and pitches. Yeah. you won't believe what I've seen in the last couple of months. That they tried to sell us really, really crazy ideas. Artificial intelligence, bartenders, and one other guy, he said he's got the revolution in sex toys, based on the blockchain. So really, really kind of weird stuff.
But you know what? People need to go out there, and especially young entrepreneurs, they need to go out there and they need to make mistakes and they need to try things. And, you know, you can't expect to hit a home run every time at bat. Like, yes, I have a successful business that runs right now, and it does very well. This is not my first business. You know, I must have had 7 failed businesses with dumb ideas. Maybe I didn't try, you know, blockchain sex robots, but still, like, you have to go out there and you got to attempt things. It's the people who don't attempt anything, who don't try anything. Those are the ones I feel sorry for, that I worry about.
Absolutely. Because failing nowadays, especially in the Western world, I think in the US it's a bit different, but failing is something that many people are scared of. And of course, when it comes to setting up businesses, in many, many countries, it's super complicated. There's so much administrational stuff you have to deal with. But still, I think that, you know, capital always goes where it's treated best. And what I can see is that many, many friends of mine, they're leaving their home countries, going to Singapore, for example, going to Hong Kong, also to Switzerland, to Liechtenstein. They're just moving to other parts of the world where they're treated better as entrepreneurs and as businessmen and as investors. And that's how it should be like. But I think that many countries don't realize that this is actually a big threat. And it's not only about when it comes to capital. That's also something that the Austrian school, I think, describes much better than other schools of thought. Capital isn't the same like money. I think capital is our, our skill set, is also our network, our friends, our families. That's also capital. And actually when millionaires are leaving a country, that's not only about the money, but it's also about the entrepreneurial spirit, the connections, the ideas, the experience that leaves the country. So from my point of view, that's very concerning for a country successful people actually leave the countries. Coming back to crypto, I think, you know, as I've said in the previous interview, it is fantastic that young people discuss money again. Is gold money, is Bitcoin money, is the US dollar better or worse money than Bitcoin or gold? That's an extremely important discussion that we have to make. And on the other hand, I think that, as we wrote in our last In Gold We Trust report, I think that gold and crypto, to some extent, are pretty similar, because they've got both Bitcoin and gold have got a very, very high stock to flow ratio. I think it's no coincidence that actually Bitcoins are mined like gold, that the logo of Bitcoin is actually a gold coin. I think it's no coincidence that the inventors of Bitcoin referred to the thoughts of the Austrian School of Economics, especially to Menger and Mises, quite often. So I think that for people understanding gold, and therefore probably also understanding fiat money, it's much easier to come to the conclusion that cryptos also makes sense. And this is the reason why last year, or basically already in 2017, we said, okay, from now on, we also want to publish a quarterly crypto research report where we analyze the crypto markets, the most important developments regarding cryptos on a quarterly basis, and we build up a great team. Demelza Hayes and Mark Wallach are doing that. So from my point of view, crypto and gold, they're not enemies. They go hand in hand. They're anti-government money. And they're some sort of monetary insurances from the dangers that our monetary system, our fiat money system, poses.
I've not had a chance to read any of your work on cryptocurrencies, but I have read In Gold We Trust, and it is about as comprehensive as I could possibly imagine. Can you dig into it a little bit for me and explain to the listeners what it is you write about specifically in the Gold Report and your outlook maybe a couple of years in the future, 5 years, 10 years, and what your expectations might be for gold?
Well, followers or readers of our In Gold We Trust reports, they know that they tend to be quite lengthy. It's a book that I'm writing together with my team every year. We publish more than 2,000 pages of research about gold, and it's, as you've said at the beginning, it's we try to deliver this holistic view. So we analyze not only gold itself, but also, of course, other currencies, the opportunity costs, for example, equity markets, real estate markets. We talk about possible crisis triggers and catalysts. We talk about the portfolio characteristics of gold. From my point of view, we're not diehard gold bugs, but we just see that gold makes sense as some sort of a portfolio insurance. So in our wealth management department, of course, we hold gold, but we also hold Swiss equities, some high quality bonds, alternative assets. I think our gold allocation is higher than for other investors, but it's not, we're not 100% long gold and mining stocks, for example. Then we talk about recession risks that are increasing. We're talking about this de-dollarization trend. So the whole world is actually slowly but gradually diversifying out of the US dollar. In December, I was in Shanghai, invited as a keynote speaker at a conference. And you can tell that, you know, the Chinese really know their gold pretty well. They know what's going on. They want to de-dollarize, so get rid of their US dollar holdings, want to diversify their currency exposure. So the de-dollarization is actually very, very big long-term trend. Then we're writing about financial repression, inflation versus deflation. At the moment, I think deflationary pressure is increasing. And this also leads me to the conclusion that 2019 will probably become very, very, let's say, interesting. And we already seen that the last couple of weeks. Then we talk about cryptocurrencies, but also precious metals shares. I really like mining stocks, especially at the moment. We just agreed on a great cooperation with a fund manager that is only doing mining stocks. So we really like mining stocks, gold and silver mining stocks at the moment. That's it basically. But there's not only the extended version, which is 230 pages, but there's also a compact version of the report, which is a bit smaller. If you don't want to spend like 2 days just reading the report, just want to get a brief overview, then there's the compact version. We've got the report in German and in English, and starting 2019 also in Chinese, or in Mandarin.
Well, it's interesting that you've mentioned China. So for any of my listeners who've been listening to the show for any length of time, they know I'm quite a bull with China. My wife is from China. We own a bunch of real estate there. I would love to hear about your experiences traveling to China and speaking over there and visiting Shanghai, and your opinions of possibly where China is heading. Because when I start doing a lot of research on gold, it seems quite apparent that they are stockpiling extra gold and possibly not letting the rest of the world know that they're doing this.
That's basically an open secret that China holds much more gold than officially published. Everybody knows that. But it's also well known that the Chinese tend to be a bit of a They've got some sort of a gambling mentality. So they really, like volatility. For them at the moment, gold is a bit too boring, I would say. So they like cryptocurrencies at the moment. Everything is all about real estate. Stock market has cooled off dramatically. So I think at some point, China will become interested in gold again, but probably, after it has, increased in prices and gained some momentum boost. But China is not only the biggest gold producer, it's also, next to India, basically the biggest, gold consumer still at the moment. So it's a terrific market. Just to give you one number, as you know, there's the Shanghai Gold Exchange, but last year in 2018, they also established the Shanghai Oil Exchange. So, there is an oil future trading now in Shanghai in renminbi terms. So you don't have to buy US dollars anymore to buy oil. And as you know, oil is by far the biggest commodity, that is traded all over the globe. And Shanghai already has a market share of 15% after a couple of months, which is, it's really astounding, and it shows you what's going on behind the curtains, and that's really another great sign of this de-dollarization. Well, coming back to the conference, it's been a great conference. I think that actually Shanghai is, of course, it's not China. It's like New York. Isn't the same like the rest of the US, of course, but Shanghai is, you know, it's super modern. It's extremely interesting to talk to businessmen there. I sometimes get the feeling that China is actually much more capitalist than the Western world. I think that the long-term outlook for China is excellent, but everybody says that at the moment it's tough. And we can see that not only from official numbers that are coming in slightly weaker, but you can see it from the, I would say, China proxies like the Australian dollar, real estate prices in Australia, but also in Vancouver, for example, that were both markets that were heavily driven by Chinese investors. We can tell from industrial metals and the commodity complex in general that Chinese demand is kind of leveling off. But I think for the longer term, I'm extremely positive, extremely optimistic about China. Also because of time preference. Time preference is also something that the Austrian School of Economics emphasizes. You have to have a really long-term low time preference. So really think long-term. If you want to achieve something, if you want to build up a solid business, a solid family, whatever, you have to think long-term. And for example, that's just a, it might sound like a stupid example, but I think it's, many of your listeners will confirm this view. Isn't it interesting that, seeing basically so many people nowadays having tattoos, and not only one tattoos but several tattoos. That's like a very, very big trend. And I don't have any tattoos, and I don't and for me it's totally okay. But after 10 years, every tattoo, I'm sorry, looks shit. It looks horrible. And I think after 20 years, you just want to get rid of it. But this shows you that people have got a very, very high time preference. They don't care about what's going on in 10 years or in 20 years. They want instant gratification. They want to experience everything now. And this is also the reason, and you're seeing it in many, many different areas. I just tweeted out a chart about how many people go into debt just to go on vacation. I mean, I think if I don't have the money, I don't go on vacation. I stay home and I work to save some money. But those are all signs that at the moment, in the Western world, we've got a very, very high time preference. And in China, it seems that the time preference is much lower, of course, also for the politicians. They don't have to care about, you know, regional elections. They don't have to care about midterm election, presidential elections, European elections whatsoever. They can stick to their long-term plans, like this China 2025 initiative, which is really interesting. So that for the long term, it really gave me a very, very positive impression, outlook for China. And I have to say, I love the food. I love the people, very hardworking people, very friendly. So I really urge everybody to travel the world, to see things with their own eyes, to feel things, to smell things, to talk to people. And that will definitely give you, a different view, not only as an investor, but also as a human being. And you will, I think, traveling, it just, changes your mind. And it's probably one of the most important things that everybody, especially young people, should do.
Well, I agree with that wholeheartedly. And it's quite interesting, some of the observations you've made about China, because I agree with you on many points. Even, I think it was 2 days ago or 3 days ago, I was sitting around having dinner with my wife and my mom. My mom lives over here in the Middle East with me. She takes care of my daughter. And there's always this thing between my mom and my daughter because they don't necessarily understand each other all that well. So because I've been to China 30, 40 times and, you know, I speak quite a good amount of Chinese and understand the culture and the food and things like this, I get it a little bit more. So we're sitting at dinner and I'm trying to explain to my mom some of the major differences between China and, say, the West, say the United States. And basically the things that come up are that in the West, we're quite a debtor nation. And in China, they don't have the same type of mentality. Like, I asked my wife a hypothetical question. If someone doesn't have money to buy something, what do they do? She's like, well, not buy it. My mom's like, well, they use their credit card. You know, they take a loan. Like, these fundamental things. And often we think that it's generational. We believe that, okay, the millennials have this type of point of view. But my wife is a millennial and she doesn't have this type of view. And a billion other Chinese, they don't have this type of view. So it's not actually age. A lot of times it's cultural. And when my daughter was born 2.5 years ago, what did she get as presents? She got presents of gold, like gold jewelry, gold necklaces, gold, not bangles like the Indian style, but Chinese style, you know? And that was the type of presents that she got. And I think that these types of cultural differences are really, really fascinating and really do tie into exactly what we're talking about with the world economic view and the gold policies and the monetary policies and what we're seeing on planet Earth.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I think that it is no coincidence. Everywhere you go, every culture, every country, every continent, and every religion came to the conclusion that gold is something special. And that's no coincidence. It's been basically a trial and error process, about for centuries, for ages, where people tried, okay, what's the best money? Is it, I don't know, goat skin? Is it salt? Is it
shells or?
Yeah, shells or. Is it gold or silver or is it paper? And I think it's no coincidence, as I've said, everywhere you go, if you go to a Hindu temple, if you go to a mosque, if you go to a Catholic church, it's always full of gold because gold is something special, something really, really precious. And that's also the fascination that I have with gold. It's something extremely conservative. It's something extremely solid. And over here in Austria, we say, Talent ist einem in die Wiege gelegt. And basically, that means that, for the baptism, the babies get gold coins, and back in the days those coins in Roman times, they were the talents, yeah, was the name of those coins. So there are many cultural and historical examples that clearly show you that the gold is something that is in our, let's say, monetary DNA, and it is really a major thing of our past, of our present, and also probably of our future. And that makes it, for me, and I'm a bit nerdy when it comes to those topics that often become very philosophical, but that makes it so special for me, because it's about trying to understand everything, history, society, politics, and then come to some sort of a conclusion.
Well, that's very interesting. And I don't want this to turn too much into an esoteric discussion, but there really is something magical about gold. It's just, when you hold it in your hands, and if any of my followers who are on social media, they know when I visited Singapore and I've got a 10 kilo or 12 kilo brick of gold in my hand, like, that's just cool. Like, you can't deny that, you know? Like, the thing's worth $500,000 and you're holding it in your hand and it's tangible and you can see it and feel it, and it doesn't rot. Like it's magical. There's just something special about gold that I've never gotten the feel of holding. Like, what do I do after I hold a dollar bill? If I go and pay something with cash, the first thing I want to do is I wash my hands. You know, I didn't do that with gold. We had a shipment of gold come to the house about a week or two ago. And, you know, it was sitting on the dresser or something like that. My wife came home and she saw it and she's holding it. And she's like, I was like, it's beautiful, isn't it? She's like, yes, it's very beautiful. And it's like, you don't get that feeling with other types of financial instruments or money or monetary or anything, even Bitcoin. I'm sorry, I don't get it. It's like, I own lots of it, and I think the concepts and the philosophy and everything like that are really fascinating, and I put my money into it, but it doesn't give me that feeling that gold does, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't know if Bitcoin will have any purchasing power in 10, 20, 100 years. I really don't know, because there's probably going to be lots of innovations and improvements. But I know that gold will have a purchasing power in 10, 20, 100 years. And I actually, that's something that John Maldin said. The best thing would be if he would be able to inherit his gold holdings to his kin, children and his grandchildren. Actually, you know, I'm a bit ahead of you, because I've got 3 daughters. So actually, I think that would be the best thing, if I would never have to really use my physical gold as some sort of a crisis hedge. Because from my point of view, it's really important to differentiate, because people often say, okay, I want to buy gold now because I expect the whole world to go down and to see a hyperinflation, whatever. Which ETF or which certificates would you recommend? And I say that's nonsense. If you really want to hedge for some extreme events, you want to have as little counterparty risk as possible. You want to hold physical gold. But if you say, okay, from my point of view, the price of gold is too low, I see rising prices, then of course you can buy different instruments like mining stocks. You can buy you can make like leverage plays with futures, options, whatever. But I think it's important to ask yourself, what is my motivation? Why do I want to hold gold? Do you want to make a decent performance, or do I really want to hedge against extreme events? That's important. And I hope that we'll never gonna need the hedge for those extreme events. Having a look at the numbers and the geopolitical tendencies at the moment, and those desperate measures taken by central bankers and politicians, it makes me quite worried, and that leads me to the conclusion that you should, of course, be heavily insured at the moment via gold, for example. I think that the purchasing power, and that's what we're also, you know, I want my readers of the report also to enjoy that time to learn from what they're reading in the report. So we always got this gold to beer ratio, showing you, the inflation at the Munich Oktoberfest, where you can buy this one mass, 1 liter of beer. And actually prices rise between 5 to 7% every year. So we said, okay, we just want to run the numbers. Does gold kind of secure your purchasing power at the Oktoberfest? And of course, your purchasing power was actually pretty stable, not 100% stable, of course, but it secured your purchasing power, and it secured you from permanent inflation. And we did the same with admission tickets to Disneyland, with Coca-Cola bottles, with Hershey milk bars, with cars, whatever. And it just shows you that over the long term, gold is a great hedge against inflation in fiat money.
Well, I love how you use real life examples, things that people can actually put in to play in their own mind, like they can understand in their own minds how this works. Because sometimes it's very difficult when we're talking about, you know, the governments and nations and stuff like that, and this nation owns 3,000 tons of gold, and this one, those types of ideas, for most people, I would say, it's very difficult to understand. But when you start explaining economics and inflation and things versus a ticket to Disney World or to go and buy a beer, that brings it back down to earth, which I really respect.
Absolutely. And that's always why, at my presentation, I always bring an ounce of gold, one beautiful Philharmonic gold coin. And I just ask people, how much rock do you have to process and do you have to move and mine, to get 1 ounce of this, of gold? And as you know, at the moment, it's average grade is like 0.8%, 0.8 grams per ton. So for 1 ounce of gold, you actually have to move like 40 tons of rock. And that's what people say. Okay. Wow. This is really impressive. And then when I say, you know, all the gold that was mined throughout history of mankind, that would fit into a cube of 21 meters. And annual production of gold would fit in a cube with four meters length and depth. That those are those examples, I totally agree, that make people really think, because everything, you know, all quantitative easing and quantitative tightening and negative interest rates and repo agreements, all that stuff and all the trillions that are printed, people just don't get it anymore, because, you know, it's just getting too complicated, and actually people are that's perhaps a good point to end our conversation. People are really, really, really worried to make ends meet and to make money, but I think many people feel like in a hamster wheel, because everything is getting, you know, faster and everybody's super stressed out because he wants to make ends meet and consume stuff that you actually don't really need, perhaps also on credit. But nobody really starts thinking about money and why we're chasing money and what money is and how it's created and how it's destroyed. So that's a bit of, I would say, the mission that we also have and that we want to kind of educate people about sound money with our reports.
Beautiful. I love it. Ronnie, if my listeners want to get a hold of you, if they want to learn more about what you do, if they want to pick up In Gold We Trust report, where can we send them?
Well, of course, everything, all our publications and information about our businesses are on our webpage, incrementum.li. Li stands for Liechtenstein. We are basically running 5 funds at the moment. There will be 3 new funds. Most of them are in the real assets business, so mostly commodities, gold, mining stocks, physical gold, but we will launch a cryptocurrency fund in a couple of weeks as well. Then we've got the research where we published the In Gold We Trust report. You can download all our 12 reports on this webpage in the archive, and you can subscribe for the new report. Also will be published end of May 2019. It's available for free, of course, in German, in English, and in Mandarin. And then we also do wealth management for private individuals. Yeah, that's actually what we're doing. I'm pretty active on Twitter. At Ron Schwefele is my handle. I tweet about Mac.
You better spell that last name for us.
S-T-O-E-F-E-R-L-E. Schwefele, that's a South German name, actually. Yeah.
And one other question I didn't get a chance to, just to put things in perspective, how many times was In Gold We Trust report downloaded last year?
The last year we had 1.7 million readers. So I think it's one of the most widely followed publications on gold. And that makes us actually very proud, and it's also a great motivation to put in so much, you know, love, work, so many hours. It's basically for a couple of months we are 24/7 just working on this report to make it really special. And it seems that people all over the world nowadays really enjoy reading the report. We are getting extremely positive feedback from all over the world, and that's the greatest motivation that one can have.
Well, I definitely recommend every single one of my listeners to go out there and download this, because it really is spectacular. And the fact that you're giving it away for free is just mind-boggling. This is an immense amount of work that would have went into this every single year. And people pay thousands of dollars for this type of research, and here you are giving it away for free. So it's a great opportunity for everyone out there to learn more about what you're talking about.
Thank you very much. Really appreciate it, Mikhail.
Thanks so much for being on the show. We'll talk to you soon. Okay, Ronnie?
Thank you very much. It's been great. I really enjoyed it. And yeah, all the best to you and your listeners. Talk to you soon.
Okay, I want to read you the reviews from the back of the book that some massively famous people in the international living space have wrote for me. See if you recognize some of these names, okay? So Gregor Gregerson says, "In Expat Secrets, Mikhail elegantly describes the many benefits that accrue to those that choose their country of residence and provides practical and timely tips and examples for doing so. This book is a game changer." Leif Simon says, "Having lived and worked overseas for more than a quarter century myself, I've seen expats make every mistake under the sun. Save yourself time and energy and learn from someone who has actually done it. Expat Secrets is the book to get you started in your international journey." Edmund John says, "Having incorporated hundreds of companies for my clients over the last 7 years, this book is very helpful for those that are starting out." And Michael Cobb says, "A huge thanks to Mikhail for clearly written, concise description of the international experience as lived by a true globe-trotting pioneer. Especially refreshing is the chapter on the benefits of raising kids overseas. As the father of two third culture kids, I can personally assure you that no education expands the mind more than growing up overseas." And my good friend David McKeegan wrote the foreword to this book, but I will let you read that yourself when you go to Amazon today and you purchase your copy of Expat Secrets. Thanks, guys.
This episode may be over, but your journey to greatness continues by visiting our webpage and signing up for our newsletter. For convenient access to new episodes, show notes, and other crucial resources, visit expatmoneyshow.com. We look forward to you joining us on the next episode of the Expat Money Show. Safe travels.
Every month, we offer exciting new webinars for our community. Topics include how to use retirement accounts to buy real estate overseas, how to get a second passport in Latin America, why you should sell your stock portfolio and move your money offshore, how to buy beachfront rental properties in Brazil for less than $100,000, or apartments in Paraguay for less than $60,000. If you want to join us for free for these presentations with live Q&A, insider secrets, and exclusive opportunities with my professional network of experts, then go to expatmoney.com/webinars. That's expatmoney.com/webinars to register for free upcoming presentations. expatmoney.com/webinars.